In early January, it would have been inconceivable that any event would push the recent tragic bushfires into the background. But this is exactly what the worldwide pandemic known as COVID-19 has done. Everything else has paled into insignificance. Had that not been the case, the spotlight would have turned very brightly onto the issue of climate change and what governments and industry needed to do to meet the challenges faced by an increasingly hotter and drier continent. Before this summer's bushfires and the arrival of the pandemic, some councils were taking action themselves on the question of climate change. On the 5th of December 2016, Darebin City Council became the first Australian council to declare a climate emergency. They were soon followed by Yarra Council on the 7th of February 2017. Since then, at least 85 councils representing more than 7 million Australians have followed suit. Two councillors led the charge at Darebin, Steph Amir and Trent McCarthy. They join us today as part of our series Leading in the Public Interest, which is brought to you by MacArthur's Talent Architects Division. Steph and Trent, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Steph, perhaps you can start off by telling us when and how the idea emerged and how it was initiated.
Sure. So the concept of a climate emergency has been around for a while, for more than a decade, and it was a concept that was developed by some Darebin local residents who were experts in the climate field, so particularly Philip Sutton, David Spratt and Adrian Whitehead and others. So there's a book written, I think, in 2005 or 6 called Climate Code Red that lays out the case for the climate emergency and what an emergency response would look like, and I suppose the model for implementing that. So it was something that was on our minds before even the election. So in 2016, Trent was already a councillor at City of Darebin. I was running for election for the first time as a candidate for the Greens, and this was one of the key platforms that we were running on, partly because it was something that we were very passionate about, but also partly because it was a really high priority for community groups in the area. It was absolutely a community-driven idea and one that we were really excited that we had the opportunity to then be able to pick up and be the first council to declare a climate emergency. And in the original model, I remember discussing this, I think it was in 2016 with some of these experts, that they had this idea that Darebin declares a climate emergency and then encourages other municipalities in Melbourne, that then might lead to other municipalities around Australia, hoping to get some commitment at a state level, at national level, and then over time have international impact. And instead what we've seen is this explosion, I think, that exceeded expectations in regard to the speed at which it's happened. So, you know, this, we saw a lot more of, I suppose, a lateral transmission of local governments and then regional and federal governments in other parts of the world really being drawn to this idea of a climate emergency. I think because it resonates with people about how they feel, that this is an emergency that needs to be tackled at emergency speed with emergency resources, and the kind of business as usual wasn't enough. And how can we make small changes to make a small difference without having too much impact on the way that people live their lives and the way that businesses is conducted, to instead coming from a different frame of what do we need to do to create a safe climate and what will it take to get there? And then recognizing that there are practical limitations, but we should start with what's needed and then work backwards from there rather than starting from where we are and working incrementally upwards.
That's a terrific introduction. So, Trent, what brought you into this arena? I can hear the passion in Steph's voice as she speaks about this. So what was your motivation for getting on board?
I think I first came into contact with the climate emergency frame or concept. In fact, when Philip Sutton and David Spratt wrote their book, Climate Code Red, which was in around 2006, 2007, and I was actually a sceptic at the time, not of climate change, but of the emergency concept, because it seemed to me at the time alarmist. And what's happened, of course, is that when you get into the the science of climate change, and you start to look at the best case scenarios and the worst case scenarios, and you apply what we describe as a risk filter, then you need to treat it like any emergency. It's a coincidence, or maybe it's a coincidence, that the 5th of December 2016 is my daughter's birthday, and it was actually on her birthday that we had our first council meeting of the new term and put forward the declaration. And in doing so, I don't think we fully comprehended the impact that would have. As of today, there are 1,732 councils or jurisdictions around the world that have declared climate emergencies. 96 are in Australia, and in fact, Darebin was the first in the world to do that. It's a really interesting example. It's the fastest growing movement of governments in history in terms of governments adopting an idea. And just on the 5th of June this year in South Korea, over 200 municipalities came together and jointly declared, covering most of South Korea. So there's this ripple effect and this explosion. The role that I think we're now very much in Darebin is that because we initiated this and our community initiated this, we have a very important custodian role. And for me, it's about the integrity of what we're doing, and it's about making sure that we can not only make the declaration, we can match that with the sort of action which Steph has talked about. So I'm a parent, and that's not the only driving factor, but I am a parent, and I look at all the climate milestones in the future and think, how old will my children be when those things likely to occur, as the scientists would say? And for me, that means that it always is there as a key focus. It's a protective factor that we need to bring into place in all government policy.
So when you took this idea to council, how much support was there initially, and how much lobbying did you need to do to get the votes to get council to pass and declare the climate emergency? Steph?
I think because there was such a strong movement in the community before the council elections, I personally felt quite confident. I assume Trent felt the same way, that there had already been enough councillors who had been elected, who had already committed during the campaign period because of that advocacy work by the community, that already committed to declaring a climate emergency if elected to council. So it meant that we could go in quite strongly, and that was one of the first things we put forward when we got elected to council in 2016. In terms of getting it through, I believe it was passed unanimously, that decision, and I guess it's probably fair to say that we're lucky in Darebin where we do have such strong support in the community. We've got quite an educated constituency, people who are very politically aware and quite community-oriented here in Darebin. And so we knew that we had the support of the other councillors and of the community before we then took that motion forward to the council chambers.
It's probably, just to add to that as well, the city of Darebin sits within what's now known as the electorate of Cooper, and which was previously known as the electorate of Batman. And we were aware that things like the ABC Vote Compass had found that our area, our electorate, had the highest level of climate concern in Australia. So we knew that in terms of putting forward a bold policy position that was actually also consistent with the science and what the scientists were saying, that we would have the backing of the community. That doesn't mean that there are going to be detractors. And there's also people, of course, who would say, why would a council be taking a position that the state or federal governments haven't taken? But if we look at the history of local government action in almost every field, it has often been local governments that have actually gone out, pioneered a policy position that has then been picked up by other levels of government. So there's a strong tradition of that, whether it's about, you know, celebrating cultural diversity, about providing rights to people who may have actually been disconnected from their rights. So there is a long history of this. And The other reality for us too, I think, which was really at the forefront of our minds, is that even if we did every single thing that we could do as a council to keep our community safe from the worst impacts of climate change, and we're talking about things like the heat island effect. So if you're in an area with a lot of concrete, not a lot of trees, which are some parts of Darebin, then people are going to struggle on hot days. And we, in fact, had the numbers in terms of how many people had been admitted to hospital and had also been close to death as a result of heat island effect. So when you have those sorts of things and you identify all the things you can do as a council, you start to realise that there are some things you actually don't have the power to do. That means that your advocacy has to be upwards through the political system to state and federal governments. And we have seen, obviously, national governments around the world adopt this same position. That hasn't happened yet in Australia, but I think it's inevitable because we now have around 96 councils in Australia, including the ACT government. That's about one in five governments in Australia has adopted a climate emergency position. And that momentum is really unstoppable now. But it's changed as well, obviously, with the COVID environment. And now we're talking much more about the economic recovery aligned with the climate emergency action.
Right. You got councillors on board very quickly. At what point did you involve council officers in a climate emergency?
Once we adopted that position, which was a policy position of the council, that triggered a kind of a working group process between a group of councillors and a group of council officers to come together over the summer holidays just after the council meeting and work through and try to understand what we'd just done and what it meant and what it could become. And our ambitions were high and lofty. We tried to work out what were the things that we could do quickly and what were the things that would take time or would require collaboration. And the officers' expertise, their sort of technical understanding of local government was really important. And I think it evolved into a partnership between councillors and officers to the point where we now have a climate emergency team of council officers. It's in our CEO's key performance indicators, action on the climate emergency. It's the number one action in our council plan. It's part of our accountability framework. Even our audit committee has a responsibility to ensure that we are delivering on and driving the sort of climate emergency action that we've committed to. So I think we understood very early that we needed to get it in the key council documents so that it was not just something that councillors spoke about, but it was also something that the organisation, the 1,300 staff at Darebin, everyone has a responsibility. Just like with workplace safety, everyone has a responsibility to report a spill. Likewise, with climate emergency, everyone has a responsibility to look at where are the opportunities for us to take action. And that means that something like our aged care service, where we have people literally going into the homes of our residents and making sure that they are fed, they're bathed, they're kept safe, that they are the frontline people in terms of also identifying what is this house like on a hot day for this person. Or can we connect this person into one of our fantastic solar programs where we get solar on the roof? So everyone has a role to play. And one of the beautiful things that happened about a year after our declaration of our climate emergency is that we had some of those community experts that Steph mentioned before, and we got them to brief 27 council officers about what the climate emergency was. And out of that meeting, out of that workshop, one of the managers who was in charge of the roads contract rushed into the CEO's office and said, I'm about to put this contract out to tender and I'd like to put it on hold because I think we can do a better job with this in response to the climate emergency. As a result, he changed the specifications in the contract, put that out to tender, and it was basically a recycled product that we now use in our road resurfacing, which is reused tyres. So we're solving an environmental pollution issue, which is that tyres stockpile, they can become a hazardous risk for the EPA, and we now actually put them into our road surface. And that's an example of empowering people in the organisation to look at those opportunities, to take that action and to reduce the carbon emissions in their work and, of course, keep our community safe from some of the worst impacts of climate change.
Okay, despite some of the impressive things that you're talking about there are some who would say that a declaration of a climate emergency is just virtue signalling. How would you respond to that view?
I think that's why it's important that the words need to be backed up with action. And, you know, council has, as Trent mentioned, detailed climate emergency plan that extends across every part of council. And it was some active work that was done to, you know, not just have the councillors on board and the CEO, and as Trent said, embedded in the KPIs, but at every level down through council. So I do agree that, you know, actions speak louder than words, and it's not enough to say that we're in a climate emergency without backing it up with action. And that has been criticism and a concern, I guess, internationally, that the level of practical response has been variable around the world. I think something else that we became aware of, you know, once we declared the emergency and we're trying to move quickly at emergency speed, then we started to think about like the reality of probably actually not being quite ready to do all of the things immediately, and there was a bit of a ramp up time. So as I suppose the leaders, that then did lead to discussions when we were talking to other councillors in other areas about the benefits of declaring an emergency and then using that as a driver to then be rolling out programs, as opposed to having everything ready to go, so that then once the emergency is declared, things are already underway, and it's really, it's easier for a council or any level of government to be able to say what they're doing right there and then. In response to something Trent mentioned before about most people being supportive but not everyone being on board, and I suppose I thought it was worth addressing that head on, that the most common we got from people who are not supportive were people saying that it wasn't the role of government to be getting involved in these sorts of things. And in response to that, I guess I'd say three things. And one is, I think that it is the role of local government to be elevating the voice of the community and to be representing the community, not just delivering services. It's not just a one directional thing, but it's a two directional relationship. So that is within the role of council. The other thing I'd say is that it's also in the role of council to be filling the gaps in services and needs that are not met by other levels of government, even when it's formally in their jurisdiction. So an example of that would be in housing. You know, housing is the role of the state government, but we don't have enough public housing. We don't have enough community housing, which is why local councils like ours are building community housing and having community housing projects, because there's so many people who don't have somewhere to live. So if that's what the need is, then we try to respond to help where we can. And the third thing to say is, when it comes to the climate emergency, we need everyone, or at least the vast majority of people, the vast majority of organisations and governments, to be taking urgent action. So that means every level of government. And, you know, for the Darebin climate emergency, we're doing advocacy at other levels of government, but most of the work is the actual practical, in the practical delivery of services by council. So like the Solar Savers program, which we'll talk about later, like planting thousands of trees, that's something that council does, like the purchase of bushland and parkland, that's something that council does, provision of green open space. All of these are things that are smack bang in the middle of council's remit. The roads, rates and rubbish, we've got the roads example that Trent gave. Rubbish is something we've been really focused on with our shift to the food waste collection, moving more into textile collection, all of these things to reduce carbon emissions through explicitly council programs and services.
What have been the financial implications for you? How much more difficult has it made for you to put together a council budget that balances or close to it, given a lot of these initiatives that you're putting in place?
It's a really good question. Just to pick up on something that Steph just said, when we think about budgeting and a budget response in a climate emergency, it's not just about new money. It's actually about how are we spending council's money and community money in a different way. So the example of our roads, rates and rubbish programs. We've used our rate system to have the largest rollout of solar installations on rooftops in Australia in any community. So we've doubled the amount of solar generation in the city of Darebin. Primarily that's been through our Solar Saver program, which enables people to put solar on their roof and being able to pay it back through their rates. So that's when council provides the finance up front, and particularly for low-income homes, but also for businesses, and people get to pay that back over a 10-year period. So that means that there's a financial outlay from council, but the vast majority of that money comes back. And that's really council operating a bit like a green bank. It does the hard work that the community itself may struggle to do on its own. In terms of actual headline costs, there's a different way of thinking about this, and this is what I think our finance department understands, is that if you think about the climate scenarios in the future, so for instance, building maintenance, if you don't look after your buildings, and you don't do the environmental upgrades that they're required to have these days, or should be required to have, then they're going to cost you a lot more and cost your community a lot more down the track. We're lucky in Darebin that we're not a coastal municipality, but some of our coastal councils who have actually declared climate emergencies haven't just done it on the basis of the science, but on the basis of the fact that their natural assets and their community assets are at direct risk from not only sea level rise or storm impact, but for instance, down at the Bass Coast Shire, the area of Inverloch, they're literally they've lost 50 metres of their beachfront in the last 8 years. Now, that's an example of a council stepping in and saying, we can't do this alone, but we are going to do everything we can to save our beach, because supports our economy and it supports our community. And I think for Darebin, we are thinking about our tree planting programs, 100,000 trees and plants planted during the COVID period to directly green up our community so that we can actually keep the place cooler and support all those sorts of both nature-based and climate responses as well.
Steph, you spoke earlier about the need for all levels of government. Federal government is not positively predisposed towards climate change amelioration and initiatives. So has that created any tensions for you with the federal government, given the strong position and the leadership that Darebin has taken?
I guess it would be fair to say that as councillors, our priority was retaining a good relationship with the councillor group, with the council staff, with the community, and representing our community. I think we did understand from the beginning that saying what was true and representing the community and doing what we thought was important was probably likely to cause some nervousness on the side of the federal government and maybe some backlash. And we did see that with the example of the decision around Australia Day and the federal government then deciding to revoke the council's ability to conduct citizenship ceremonies. For us, that's something that I guess had a positive side in that it did help to then elevate the issue. Of course, when it comes to the media likes conflict. So by having that backlash, it then did in some cases help to elevate the issue, raise it up to a state and national level that allowed more people to hear about the climate emergency, to have input, to hear about what's going on and hopefully then be advocating for their own local government and state and federal government to follow that path as well. But climate emergency, I'd say, was one of several issues where there has been disagreements with the approach that we've taken to federal government, the other ones, and also on marriage equality probably be similar as well. But we felt it was important to represent our community, and the reality is that we know that we live in a community where people do feel passionately about climate change, and that was something that was important to us. And it probably is true to say that some of the views in Darebin were different from the views in some other parts of the country. And I remember around a few of these issues getting tweets or negative comments from, in some cases, state MPs from conservative areas saying, "You say you are representing the people, but you don't." And I responded saying, "I'm representing Darebin. You might be representing a conservative area, but by making this statement, you are demonstrating that you don't understand what the people in Darebin want. And we do. And that's why we're acting in the way that we did."
I want to come back to the process of the declaration of a climate emergency, but in a slightly different context. You had a community that was strongly behind you. You had a council that was united in going forward with the declaration of a climate emergency. But what advice would you give a council that was considering declaring a climate emergency that didn't have the unanimous support of the community and the council in the same way that you did at Darebin?
It's a great question. There are three main ways that councils end up declaring a climate emergency. One is the sort of model that Darebin had, which was a sort of a council-led approach, and that's very much the councillors already want to see it happen. Another model is where it comes from the community, so it's a grassroots movement, and most of the declarations that happened in the United Kingdom came through that way. So there was a huge upsurge of climate concern, and the groups that were advocating for action use the climate emergency as a framework on that front. The third way is a deliberative process, which I think if any council is unsure if this is where they want to head, this is a great example of what they can do. Mount Alexander Shire, which includes towns like Castlemaine, their councillors were actually divided. And in fact, at one stage, despite them having pockets of what you might describe as kind of progressivism in some parts of that community, they also had people that were very reluctant about the term emergency because of their experience with bushfires and what they would describe as traditional emergency concepts. And so they held a process where any member of the community could come and make a submission, and all the councillors effectively had to sit and listen to all these submissions and ask questions and engage with this process. This went for 9 hours, and they had lots of people from a broad cross-section of the community make submissions through this process. It was such a powerful experience because it united the eldest members of the community and the youngest, those that were of a low income and those who were relatively wealthy, business owners, residents, people that lived in the towns, people that lived outside of town. And what it showed was that this was a community that felt deeply and felt very concerned about climate change. What they wanted their council to do was to take a position that was commensurate with the science and to do everything they could through their own voice and through their own action, understanding that a council in a regional area is not going to solve climate change, but what they can do is do everything they can to keep their community safe. And as a result, that shifted the council in terms of supporting a declaration. And that council is now one of the 96 councils in Australia that is part of our Climate Emergency Australia movement, which is actually a united front of all those declared councils. So I think the deliberative process is a great way. We've had more conservative councils where the councillors were not on board at all, but the council officers said, this is coming, this approach of thinking about climate change is coming. So you've got a choice, councillors, about whether or not you resist this or whether you embrace it and see it as an opportunity to partner with other councils and potentially partner with other levels of government to take meaningful action. And I know conservative councillors who are, sort of paid up members of conservative political parties in Australia that would 3 years ago would have said, no way, no thanks. We've actually come on board and said, we understand what this means now because we have seen the devastating impacts of the climate emergency already.
It's interesting, Trent, that you talk about the deliberative process. The first of our podcasts, in fact, featured Amanda Stone from Yarra City Council, who won a MacArthur Fellowship to look at the application of deliberative democracy in decision-making in council. So it's nice to sort of close that circle for us. But I want to ask you another question. Every idea such as this starts with a view of your desired future. To what degree has the symbolic and very practical act of declaring a climate emergency at Darebin helped both the two of you and Darebin Council achieve your vision of the desired future? Steph, could you?
Sure. I think the point that Trent made earlier is very relevant around the use of the word emergency, and it can, I guess, lead to immediate action, but also fear. And sometimes if people are too fearful, it can cause paralysis. And I do feel that within myself. In fact, I'm thinking of making a little cartoon about the cycle that I keep going around where the situation seems so overwhelming that it's hard to know where to start and it seems insurmountable. And then by focusing on a small action, then you can gain confidence and momentum and optimism. And then that confidence, momentum and optimism then links you in with other people who are doing other work. And I guess the scale of what seems possible continues to grow. And then as it continues to grow, things get bigger. But then also as it gets bigger, it gets more complicated. And there have been complications with climate emergency declaration and application in Darebin, for example, with people having different views about the best way forward, how to prioritise things and so forth. And then with that complexity, then things become stressful and overwhelming again. And again, we get paralysed. And I feel like as an individual, I frequently go through that cycle on a daily or weekly or monthly basis. But now that I've learned that, I know that when you do feel paralyzed with fear and not knowing what to do, you have to start somewhere, and doing something is better than doing nothing. And even if the one thing you do that day is plant some seeds in the garden so that you can then grow your own vegetables rather than having to buy them from a supermarket where they've been shipped in from on a plane overseas, for example, then that then can give the confidence to be able to grow that in and link in with other people doing work. So with the climate emergency, one thing that has been really exciting is that we started this process feeling so optimistic and excited about having a future that was different from the path that we were on or potentially are still on, with all of the dangers that climate change will bring, to a future that could be safe. And we have to keep that vision in mind to continue to drive us forward. But then similarly, I suppose, as an individual and other individuals as well, as we go through those loops of feeling despair and feeling fear and paralysis, that then there's others who are powering forward and continue the movement going, so that the movement continues in a way that is not dependent on a small number of individual people as it was in the beginning.
So, Trent, where do you see Darebin going from here? A change initiative. I mean, you're a leader, first one to come on board with declaring a climate emergency. Now you've been joined by lots of councils. What's next for Darebin?
Almost 12 months to this date, in fact, we took a proposal to the National Assembly of Local Government to ask them to also recognise the climate emergency. And it was I was the council delegate for Darebin. That was a year ago. We went to Canberra, we put the case, and we got 67% of the assembled councils to get on board with that, which was fantastic. So that became the position of the Australian Local Governments Association. At the time, I floated the idea that at that stage we had about 40 councils that had declared climate emergencies, and I said, we need to get together. And so we got together online. We had a couple of meetings also internationally with councils, and I floated the idea of us setting up a thing called Climate Emergency Australia. And I'm really pleased that 12 months on, we've now got a whole group of councils from around the country that have co-contributed to setting this up as the collective lobbying force for what local government needs to act on the climate emergencies. That is in the process at the moment. It's about to be launched. It's very exciting. It's a way of us mobilising the collective power of local governments from across the country, whether it's our colleagues up at the City of Darwin who are at the forefront of generating renewable energy, which they're exporting overseas, which is amazing. So exporting renewable energy from Darwin to Singapore is an example of, you know, new thinking around our response. All the way through to our coastal councils coming together. And for me, Darebin's role is that we must maintain integrity in this movement. We must also continue to demonstrate through our action on the climate emergency is possible at all levels of government. So that's the role modelling piece. And I think also picking up on Steph's point before, we need to remain hopeful because simply by saying, so for instance, I always equate the emergency declaration as seeing the fire on the horizon and saying there's a fire and we can either ignore it and turn our backs or we can address it and approach it with positivity, with passion, with collaboration and turn that into an opportunity. And so I've worked in the fire service and I know what happens in a group of firefighters is that they come together and they work like family to solve a problem collectively. And that's the sort of thinking and approach which we're already seeing out. What's been really motivating for me is that when we've gone out to our community in Darebin and this is the situation, what can you do? They've come back with the most incredible ideas. And it's no surprise that some of our businesses have powered ahead, covering their rooftops in solar panels. They are wanting to make this part of what their business is because they know that this is where the public is, but they also know it's about thinking about the future. So I think our role is not just about what we do, it's what we inspire and empower others to do with us. And the best solutions do come from often outside of institutions. It's when institutions recognise those and elevate those is when you get that sustained positive social change.
Are there any specific projects or any specific commitments that you're working on at the moment?
Probably the biggest one, which we are so excited about, is what's called the Local Government Power Purchase Agreement. And this is where Darebin City Council set out to say, how do we switch our electricity consumption from fossil fuels to renewables and how do we do that in the most cost-effective measure that we can do that? And what we worked out through this process is that the best way for us to do that was actually to do that in partnership with other councils. So we set about, we got one of our council workers to focus purely on this for over 12 months and he connected up with over 50 councils around Victoria. So there are 79 local councils in Victoria and he spoke to most of them and got them to come on board and agree to collectively pool their electricity consumption under the one agreement. We're in the final throes of this at the moment and so it will be something that kicks on and becomes a real thing in 2021. But we've got councils that had never thought about doing this before that have committed 100% of their electricity consumption to this project. And it means that amongst these councils, there are over 40 of them, we are collectively pooling our electricity consumption, going out to the market and saying, give us a solution that delivers 100% renewable energy. Now, what this is likely to happen is it will finance either wind farm or solar farm activity. It'll create jobs in a regional community and it will mean that we as a council will be able to not only say we're doing everything we can to support our residents, but we're also completely shifting the electricity market in Victoria. It is the largest power purchase agreement of any government in the country, and it shows what councils can do when they work together and they have a value that they put, which they want to achieve. And in this case, we're basically helping councils, over 40 councils, switch to renewables And in fact, in most cases, they're actually going to be saving money, which is a really exciting thing to be able to say to your ratepayers as well, is that we're going green and we're actually saving you money too. And people are very excited about this. Obviously, we've got council elections in Victoria in October. And I suspect that climate emergency declarations will continue to be one of the critical issues for budding and aspiring councillors and council candidates. And I'll certainly be making sure that people know what's possible when a council does declare a climate emergency, what they can then do and get on with the job of taking real action and keeping their community safe.
So speaking of elections, what are your intentions, both of you? Would you be standing again for council or have you run your race?
I'm in currently my third term of council, so I'm planning to put my hand up again. So, and partly one of the main reasons, apart from some fantastic local projects that are happening that I really want to see happen and certainly continue to support them on council, is also our work in partnership with other councils and communities. So it's our work on climate, our work on building a nature trust as well. It's been a big journey, and I've had a child every term of council, but not this term. So I kind of, my wife said, you can run for council again, but we're not having any more kids. So.
Fair enough. Steph, what are your plans?
So I've decided not to contest the next election. I'm certainly not stepping away from politics forever, but I'm taking the next term off, I suppose, is how I'm phrasing it. My daughter was born 2 months after I got elected, and was certainly quite a challenge. And then seven months after that, I got very sick, ended up in ICU and have ongoing disabilities from that illness. So it's been a wild ride, I'd say. It was a lot going on in the last 3.5 years, and I've been really proud of what we've been doing on council. And it's such a wonderful role and such a wonderful privilege. And I want to make sure that, you know, if I'm being a councillor, I can be the best possible councillor I can be. So I'm going to take the next term off. We're hoping to have another baby, and I'd rather not do that at the same time as having a new council role and a new baby at the same time. That was quite a challenge. But certainly I've spoken to many, many people who encouraging them to run for council, particularly those who are passionate about climate change and making a difference. I actually had a previous role running a program called Pathways to Politics, which was for prospective female politicians of any political alignment and giving them the skills and networks and competence they needed to run for council. So even though I'm not in that role formally anymore, I still have met with a lot of people talking to them about what it means to be a councillor. And it is something that a lot of people sort of don't know what's involved. And I think the community deserves to have the best possible people to choose from in the election. So that's a role I'll be continuing, and then see what happens.
Look, clearly Darabin's been a leader in this whole issue of climate change, not just in the declaration of a climate emergency. And listening to the two of you, it's quite clear that Darabin's not going to hand over that leadership role very quickly to someone else. Trent and Steph, thank you for joining us today to talk about the story of Darabin City Council declaring a climate emergency and the impact it's had on the council, the community, and the two of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to another podcast in the series Leading in the Public Interest, brought to you by MacArthur's Talent Architects Division. Today, we spoke with Steph Amir and Trent McCarthy from Darabin City Council about that council's decision to be the first in Australia to declare a climate emergency, what was involved in doing so, and the practical implications. We hope you'll continue to support us and these podcasts as we continue to identify and deal with questions about what it means to lead in the public interest. Today's podcast was produced by Lynn Dang, and the music was composed and performed by Gideon Price. Until we catch up again, stay safe and well.